Welcome to Beer, Beats, and Business, the business podcast for smart people who appreciate the insights found in a good conversation. That guy sitting at the end of the proverbial bar is your host, David J.P. Fisher, but everyone around here just calls him D. Fish. He's an author, speaker, and business coach. Basically, he's a professional talker. So grab a glass of your favorite beverage, grab a seat, and join us for today's episode. Let's see where the conversation takes us.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another interesting conversation with an interesting person. And today, in the role of my interesting conversational partner, is my good friend, Laurel Miltner. Laurel is a digital marketing strategist and speaker who works with clients every day to make the internet better for humans and for robots. And by the way, hi Laurel, how are you?
Hey, I'm well. How are you?
You know, I'm living the dream. And one of the reasons I am living the dream is I am drinking a beverage from our sponsor, Sketchbook Brewing. And one of the best compliments I can pay Sketchbook is I drink their pale ales and their IPAs. I am drinking the No Parking Citra Pale Ale. And as you might know, and my listeners definitely do, I don't usually go for the hoppy beers. I know you do, Laurel, but I love you anyways.
I do. I am a big Sketchbook fan.
Good, as you should be. They're fantastic. And this is a very tasty beer. So that is what I am drinking. And I know that they call it No Parking because way back when they got started, you had to go into their brewery through a door in the alley, which of course had a big No Parking sign right next to it. So anyways, here is my question, Laurel. Who is the internet for, humans or robots?
It's for humans. It's got to be for humans. But the robots help us find the right things, I think, and categorize things and make sense of all of the information and data that's out there. So I always look at things that I'm creating or things that I'm optimizing as being for humans first and foremost, but, you know, making sure that they are structured for robots, that they are written in a way that robots can access and understand what they're about and help us, you know, organize everything. I kind of see the robots like a giant Dewey Decimal System or card catalog that we used to dig through at the library. Without it, we're lost in a stack of books.
I'm just remembering that day in grade school where we went to we had a little library in our grade school, and the librarian explained the Dewey Decimal System. And I just, even at that point, remember going, this makes no sense.
Oh, it's crazy.
it's a good idea.
Brilliant and crazy. And it actually worked. And now we have algorithms and Google and a bunch of smart people helping us do that in the online world.
Well, there you go. And you're one of them. In fact, I was kind of amused when I was looking at your bio because I realized digital marketing strategist is definitely one of those job titles that even 10 years ago, people would be like, well, what's that?
Oh, yeah. And it still means so many different things to different people.
Well, so what is a digital marketing strategist? Let me ask that question for my own edification as much as anybody else listening.
Sure. Again, I think it means a lot of different things to different people. I see it as what I see, I guess, as my role is I help clients understand what they are trying to achieve through their online channels from a business perspective and make sense of that through their website largely, but also, you know, all the ways that people get to that site, all the ways that people can find and access and engage with that information.
Cool. Okay. So it's exactly what it says it is. It's creating strategy around this one part of a business, which, you know, didn't really exist 20 years ago.
Right.
What, to that end, do you find it often challenging to work with clients because they don't have a background in what they should be doing because it is so new? Or is that make it actually easier because people don't know what they should be doing? So they'll listen to what you say.
Yeah, I think it's particularly challenging for large established organizations because they're already operating often in silos, you know, across departments and across parts of the business or business lines or services or products. You know, in large organizations, people are typically working with their group and working across those, even just from a day-to-day business perspective, you know, collaborating across marketing and sales or, you know, one product team to another can be challenging on its own, I think has been historically. And when you add the complexity of doing that online and having a consistent voice for all of your clients or customers, making sure that you're getting the right information in front of them without jargon and without that internal competition coming to a head, it can be really, really challenging. I also find it's difficult for companies sometimes to really get out of their own heads in a way and understand the language that people use online and all the different ways they search. And voice search is changing that, you know, exponentially as we speak. Optimizing for search is different than it used to be even a year or 6 months ago as people talk more into their phones and into their, you know, smart devices. It really changes how we write, how we organize, how we structure all of the information that we're putting online so that people can find it, no matter how they're looking for it.
Interesting. So are you saying that the way that people search, and not even including voice, because I know that's changing things a lot too, but basically that the way people search or the way that people ask questions online is different than you might think they're going to ask your question, or that you, or is it just that companies aren't even thinking about how people are going to ask, and rather just saying, well, I want to put my information out this way, and then people are just going to have to find it on their own?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's really hard to be ego-free, I think, especially when you've created a business or a product or a service that you're really proud of, and especially one that you've branded and have a message house around, right? So balancing that with how someone is going to find it, what they're going to search to find it, with still getting, you know, your brand name, your product name, and your kind of like core value proposition up front. It takes a lot of art and science blended together. And it takes a lot of trust, I think, especially for organizations that aren't, you know, as digitally savvy or are really trying to make a move and make a change with their online presence. It takes a little bit of a leap of faith in some cases to be willing to fight for the searchers and the robots, especially within and across your internal teams.
Yeah. So I'm even thinking for especially the established companies that you're sharing struggle a lot with this, they almost have no way of, let's say, auditing or monitoring what the digital team is doing. So there's a lot of trust because they don't understand it themselves, right? Especially if you think about leadership in a lot of big organizations. Heck, if they're 50, they didn't, that, you know, that CEO, that COO, whoever's in charge, even the CMO, might not have grown up with the internet, right? They're not a digital native. So when you as a digital strategist say, well, no, you have structure like this, it might be counterintuitive, or it might just not make sense to them. And they kind of have to say, okay, I trust you to do this. Don't mess it up.
Exactly. And then the nice thing about the internet is I always say, you know, you're publishing a website, not a book. So you can always change it. It's not in print forever. And a lot of the tools that we're able to use today give us the opportunity to test things against one another, put out like a minimum viable product and see what works and iterate from there. So it does take a leap of faith. It does take some trust, but the data is right at our fingertips to show people when things work and when they're not. And the speed of the ability to publish and change things helps us be able to stay on our toes and fix things when they don't go right.
Well, that's a good point. I like that. What are you seeing right now that people are doing well? Like the people that have good digital marketing strategies, what are kind of the big things that they're doing right these days?
That's a really deep question. I think probably one of the biggest...
I'm a deep guy. Come on. I'm still deep.
I think one of the biggest, I guess, trends or biggest moves that I see people making, especially on the back of, you know, your Amazons, your Facebooks, is trying to lean into personalization. Which means, you know, how you buy something on Amazon and they're like, hey, you might like this also. Or you watch a movie on Netflix and they're like, check this thing out because you watched this and that, or you liked this thing. Companies are now trying to do that across their content. You read this, you might also like this.
Right.
And then, you know, use that to move people to make a purchase, to dive into a new product, all those kinds of things. It's really challenging. There are some ways to do it, you know, so slowly, softly, kind of test the waters. But that's really what consumer expectations are moving towards. So it's where brands are following.
It's interesting because that also makes me think that's just a fine line between effective marketing and creepy stalking.
Yep. Right? I mean, to call it the cool and creepy line.
Cool. Yeah. Well, because I'm nowhere near as versed as you in any of this, but I've read a few articles and I've heard a few, you know, workshops on digital marketing, some of these different search engine optimization stuff, all that kind of fun stuff. And so I'm kind of aware now when, for example, I search for something on Google and then all of a sudden all of my ads on Facebook or on Amazon even are different, mm-hmm. right? Or the one thing that I drives me absolutely nuts when you search for something and then you buy it, but yet still for the next couple of weeks, mm-hmm. you're getting advertised. And it's kind of hard to figure out where I get as a company, you want to try to maximize, but at a certain point, do you think there's going to be pushback? Like, dude, back off. creepy is not going to get you my digits at the end of the night, you know?
You know, I think it is a really fine balance that companies and brands need to walk in order to do it well. I am probably the biggest like Luddite for someone in my industry because I don't want to have a smartphone. I don't want to have a smart device in my house. I try to avoid things like, you know, I set my privacy settings. I do a lot of things to try and avoid things that people in my industry do try and use to target and personalize at times. It can feel a little bit invasive. I remember the first time I ever had an ad show up because I had looked at a product, and it was in probably, I don't know, 2011 or 2012. I was looking for a KitchenAid stand mixer, and I saw an ad the next day for the exact color and model that I was looking at. And I tweeted to them and I said, whoa, what is going on here? And they actually told me how to turn off my settings so that I didn't have to be followed by that ad. I would be shocked if a brand did that today, at least, you know, proactively like that. There's ways to take control of it. There's ways to manage it. You can Google things like, you know, changing your privacy settings and how to have things, you know, follow you a little bit less directly, how to change your profile in Google to manage those settings. But if I'm realistic, I think that that's just kind of the direction that our world is going. And especially mm-hmm. in America, people don't tend to care quite as much about their privacy as they might or as they do in other countries. So I just see it kind of being more and more, and we will find the right trade-off for ourselves in terms of getting value out of those things when companies are doing it well. And I think we will reward the companies that do it well, and we will mm-hmm. punish the ones that don't, and we'll net out somewhere on the end where hopefully there's a nice balance for everyone.
Hopefully. And I think it's interesting though that you said that you're kind of a Luddite. By the way, I'll put a link in the show notes for anybody who wants to know what a Luddite is. It's definitely worth knowing. But I've referenced myself in some ways as a Luddite as well. And I'm actually thinking as you said that. So basically a Luddite, for, you know, if you don't know, was a bunch of people in mid 1800s England who were anti-technology, or maybe 19th century. I'm not, somewhere on there. But they were anti-technology. What's interesting is I don't think saying I don't want to be followed by information everywhere, I don't want to have my privacy invaded, that shouldn't make you a Luddite. Like, I love my technology. I have my phone. I use many screens every day. I'm totally fine with it. I think I should be able to stand up for my rights mm-hmm. as an individual and not be branded that way. Not that you're calling me a Luddite or I'm calling you a Luddite, but right. But it's interesting that we feel we have to defend ourselves and say, no, you can't just follow me around. Like that'd be like saying, hey, I know it makes me kind of a jerk to say, please stop stalking me.
That's an interesting point.
And I think that Americans, you made the point that we're not as privacy oriented. And this is truly, I don't know, but I don't think that we're any less privacy oriented in some ways than the rest of the world. We've just maybe up to this point thought we haven't had a choice, or maybe just the environment is more pro-business and you've had the Google, Facebook, Apples of the world just kind of running roughshod over everything with very little oversight.
I mean, and they were born in our backyard, right? So
yeah,
there is the American entrepreneurial spirit, the American business spirit that has driven all of these organizations, and we have found value in what they give us.
100%.
There's just, you know, I mentioned the American aspect simply because you see some other countries moving faster in terms of setting privacy laws and even, you know, taking some steps toward laws for AI programming before we're seeing it here.
Right.
I don't.
Well, there's, what is it? I always get the four letters wrong.
GDPR. Yes.
Nice. I got it right.
The Global Data Privacy. I'm blanking on the exact acronym. I will remember it in a moment.
Sure.
Or I'll Google it and pretend like I remember off the top of my head. But you see California laws are now following suit and having similar restrictions and laws coming on the back of GDPR, which is the General Data Protection Regulation in the EU.
There you go. Well searched. Right?
Go ahead.
No. So it's really interesting. So you used Google there, right, to find that.
Fair point.
And that was useful. Something I think is really valuable, and it's something that I think that we don't in general think about. This is not an American thing, it's just a human thing, is with these platforms, we're basically making a agreement, right? So for example, Google has, and they've never hidden this or lied about it. They're like, we'll give you free information, free search information. And the way we're going to pay for that is we're going to do advertising because you've given us some attention and we're going to monetize that. And I think that's okay as long as you walk in, right, as a full and knowing participant in the contract you're about to sign, mm-hmm. metaphorically, sure. Right?
Well, I mean, not metaphorically, because everyone's got user agreements, but I doubt many people read them.
You mean the 30-page
exactly.
Legally?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we sign off on it, but nobody reads all of those things. So we do, I suppose, opt in, but we aren't 100% clear on what we're opting into at all times.
Well, To their credit, you know, Google has, because I think of some of this pushback, and I'm just, Google is by no means the only actor in this dramedy, but Google, you are seeing a lot more attention being paid to, okay, here, we're going to make the privacy settings easier to find. Like, what a concept. It used to be, you've got to know this specific website and click this button and go down to this submenu and look on page 4. Now it's like right there. And so even just that's fine because, hey, if I want to opt in, let me opt in. But if I want to opt out and, you know, you can still get some usable advertising eyeball time from me, then that should be good too, right?
I think yes and no. Definitely agree with you philosophically. I think what we have run into and will continue to run into is opting out of using some of these products and services isn't a great option for surviving and thriving in the modern world. There was a great series, I think it was on Gizmodo, called Goodbye Big Five.
Okay.
I'll double check that and confirm. But so
We'll put it in the link. Great. The show
notes. Good by Big Five. One of their writers tried to survive a week without some of the tech giants. So like a week without Google, a week without Amazon, et cetera, and then tried to do all five at the end. And it's very eye-opening and alarming to see the kinds of things you run into. Like one example that stood out to me was, you know, the reCAPTCHA that you see anytime you fill out a form online, pretty much on any website, and you have to like, you know, say I'm not a robot and maybe
click on the boxes. You have to prove to the robot that you're not
one. On the boxes with all the cars or whatever. That's Google powered. So if you're trying to opt out of everything that's Google, you can't operate on any site or get through that barrier on any site if you're opting out of using
Google. Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
And again, that's just one small example of a lot of things that this woman came across in her exploration. So yes, we have a choice. How viable making that choice in a really like hard stance kind of way is questionable. Hmm.
So it sounds like it's a good thing that as long as we can go into the relationship with some knowledge, that's better than just saying, I'm not going to use it, right? Like, because maybe you definitely can't. Well, I mean, this conversation is both inspired and terrified me. So fantastic. So how do you, taking in all of that, that's the world kind of that you have to live in. What are kind of the areas that you focus on to make sure you're doing it, doing this kind of strategy work on the cool side as opposed to the creepy side? Is it just like an awareness thing or?
I mean, it's an awareness thing. I think there is an ethical part of any of the work that you're doing to make sure that you're really, everything that I do and everything I do for my clients, I try to make sure that we're genuinely aiming to provide value.
Okay.
Provide value for the person that is finding that information, provide value for the person that is looking for whatever they're looking for. I think if you go in it with, you know, generosity and empathy and ethics front of mind, mm-hmm. You're doing a job to make our world and our online world a better place for people. And that's what I hope to do. That's what I try to do. That's what I aspire to do.
Interesting. So in some ways you're kind of taking that idea of the internet as a place and going, okay, how do I make this place better?
Yeah. I mean, it was made to be a place for people to connect with one another and find information and share information and share value. There's a lot of good and bad, I think, going on online and in social networks and with, you know, screen time and devices that children are using before we know what that does to their brains. Right. There's a lot of, you know, I kind of have a love-hate internet relationship with the internet, but I think at the end of the day, if we look at what it's set out to do in the beginning and lean in on those values in everything we do as practitioners, then we are providing a good service and doing the best that we can with what is available to us.
Right. No, that makes sense. In the end, it's a tool, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a book. A book is simply a tool. It could have something good in it. It have something bad in it. You could put it in a library. You could sell it for $1,000. There's a lot of different ways you can package information, but it's really how do you use this tool? And to your point, for the most good, as opposed to being misused for nefarious purposes.
Indeed.
I like it. So let's switch to lighter things. Okay. What are you drinking right now?
Right now I'm just drinking water. I am boring. No. Oh,
metaphorically, okay. You're being a smart guest and letting me know I'm here drinking alone. What's your favorite beer you're drinking right now? Because you are one of my fellow beer snobs.
Yes. No offense to your sponsors, because I do love Sketchbook, especially their Insufficient Clearance. But my favorite right now is from Old Irving Brewery. They have a beer called Beezer. That's a hazy IPA.
Okay.
It recently won the gold medal in the hazy IPA category at the Great American Beer Festival. And it's delicious, and the people that make it are wonderful. I am incredibly spoiled because the brewery is about a 15-minute walk from my place, and I am there often hanging out with the brewer and the bartender and my friends. And I'm really happy to see them being so successful and really truly spoiled by the wonderful beer that they make and is now like starting to be distributed and seeing some traction.
Awesome. And hey, Old Irving Brewery, if you want to be a sponsor, we'll just get Laurel to come on every show and talk about how good you are for a while. I have no problem with that. That's awesome. So it was called Beezer?
Beezer, B-E-E-Z-E-R. If you're in the Chicago area, it's starting to get into Binnie's.
Nice. Yeah, hazy IPAs, I'm going to leave those for you. Yes, I love the sketchbook IPAs. I'm enjoying them. That's just too hoppy for me. I can't do it.
That's fair.
I'll try.
Although it's pumpkin ale season. I don't know how you feel about the pumpkins.
You know, so fan. Here's the I'm kind of a purist around beers. That's you know, true. Not that I need the purity laws from Germany or anything like that, but in general, adding stuff, you know, beer's delicious without it, but to each their own. And that's, as everybody knows, that is my philosophy. Even if I don't dig it, if you dig it, that's all that matters. But what I do love in the fall, you know, which is the same time the pumpkin stuff comes out, is always when you have the Oktoberfests. And I'm a big Marzen fan. So that usually takes me from September through November, you know, and I love it even when I can get the couple six packs of Marzens that are left and they're like, oh, we got to put these on clearance to just get rid of them. I mean, come on, beer doesn't go bad that quickly. It's a great way to stock the refrigerator. So it works out well. Awesome. Well, I think that's a great place for us to wrap this up.
Okay.
We've talked about the possible overthrow of the robots or our human ability to use this new tool and make it work for us. We've talked about hazy IPAs. I mean, all the major points. I always ask all of my guests at the end, what's one piece of advice you would give somebody to make today a little bit better? What would yours be, Laurel?
This is probably very cheesy and maybe stereotypical, but I am a big fan of the moment of just taking a breath and consciously thinking about something today that made you smile or that brought joy to your world. And also, if you can find a moment to do that for someone else.
Cool. I don't think that's cheesy at all. I like it. So everybody, check out Sketchbook, our sponsor for this show. They're doing great stuff. I am now pretty much finished with my no parking Citra Pale Ale. Laurel, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And everybody, well, it's good. It's supposed to be fun. It's just talking, hanging out. And everybody, we will talk to you next time on Beer, Beats, and Business. Have a good one. Peace.
Thanks for stopping by. You can find show notes and links in this episode at beerbeatsandbusiness.com. We all know the best way to find out about a new podcast is through our friends. So please help us out and share what we're doing through social media, or just tell someone. And if you could do us a favor and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, like iTunes or Stitcher, that would be great. Want to get in on the conversation? Send DFish a message on Twitter at DFishRockstar. And we'll save a spot for you at the bar for the next Beer, Beats, and Business.